Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today, 1 year in, after a coordinated effort and tens of millions of dollars spent, what has Operation Rio Grande accomplished? Also, medical marijuana opponents are making a novel argument in their case against a ballot initiative that it's an affront to religious liberty of members of Utah's predominant faith. Plus, what should we call the big local church in town anyway? And the tiny star missing from your driver's license and the headaches that it's not being there might cause you. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune Managing Editor David Noyce. Glad you're with us, David.
Good morning. Good morning. Thanks.
We've also got reporter Peyton Harkins. Welcome to you, and thanks as well.
Hey, thank you.
And Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. Gerke, we'll name a chair after you here soon enough. This is a three-peat for you.
Yeah,
thanks for being
three in a row. Thank you.
Listeners, we invite your comments and questions on the stories that we're covering today. You can post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com, or you can call us up. We are at 801-355-8255. Let's start today with the one-year anniversary of the launch of Operation Rio Grande. Peyton Harkins, this was an effort centered around homelessness and crime in the Rio Grande neighborhood, and in fact, that's an ongoing effort. But $67 million, and 1 year later, the officials behind this plan met this week to highlight some of what had been accomplished so far and also to talk about the next steps in this process. This is kind of a broad question, Peyton, but can you help us quantify what has been accomplished? And one entry point here might be something that city, county, and state officials point to, which is a reduction in crime in the city. What has been the impact on crime?
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the biggest things they'll point to, is that across Salt Lake City, from the time Operation Rio Grande started until now, it's like crime is down about 25% all around. And like, you look at the Salt Lake PD keeps data about like where crime is occurring in the city based on city council districts. And so you look, and there are some districts, you know, south of downtown where there have been spikes in crimes like burglary and assault. But even in those districts, I mean, crime is down overall. So I think that'd be the first thing they point to. But then something else is that they've been able to decrease the number of days that people actually need to be in shelters. I think, what was the number?
I mean,
don't remember.
Reduced by 5 days.
Yeah, something like that. And so I think that those two things would be the two big things. And they'd also, like, in my conversations with people, they'd just say, like, look outside. You know, like if you look outside in the Rio Grande area, there are noticeably less folks just kind of hanging around.
Right. In that specific neighborhood, and there are some complaints about that I want to get to a little bit later, but just sticking with the sort of the positive benefits that city officials, state officials, county officials are pointing to, and crime data in particular, are they saying that the decrease in crime is a result of Operation Rio Grande? Is that right?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah.
You know, you wrote about the arrests that have occurred as part of this, 5,100 people in total arrested. That seems like a big number. And I bring that up because at the outset, a year ago, we had officials like House Speaker Greg Hughes saying, you know, we can't arrest our way out of this problem. What happened with those who were arrested? How were they, you know, basically what became of them?
Well, I mean, looking at the data, it seems like the vast majority of those folks, I mean, they'd get booked into jail, and then depending on what the offense they were booked in on, like if it was nonviolent, I mean, they'd very quickly just get back out into the streets, you know. Mm-hmm. Those would be people, you know, caught for things like just having drugs on their person or something like that. There's just not enough room in the Salt Lake County Jail for those type of offenses. You know, it's a little bit different maybe if they're the people distributing the drugs, like the, you know, the drug dealers or something like that. Like maybe they would stay in jail a little bit longer. But for the most part, I mean, you see people just coming right back out.
Right.
But I mean, on that note, though, I mean, there are some things that folks, you know, could I don't know, there'd be some positive aspect of this in terms of like they could be put into this new drug court system, you know, instead of just, you know, getting back out on the streets or having that like misdemeanor or something on their record, they could go through this alternative program that would help them get some treatment, which, you know, is the reason that we had Operation Rio Grande in the first place, is to try to curb that.
Robert, yeah. Your comments there.
Well, and they've had 132 people who've I guess pled into the drug court program, which means then they get diverted into a treatment program rather than being locked up for extended periods of time. And that's you know, that tackles one of the underlying problems with homelessness. The drug use is a pretty common theme in a lot of these circumstances, and then the sort of the long term goal is to get people into work and housing, and they've had 106 people who've gone in through this Dignity of Work program have been able to get training for jobs and find hopefully long term stable jobs to be able to afford a stable house, and so they're not going to just be cycling back out onto the street. I mean, controlling the crime is sort of the if you're a doctor, that's stopping the bleeding, basically, right? You've got to do the triage at the outset, and then you've got to control the drugs on the street, right? Which is part of the controlling the crime. But in the long run, it's got to be finding people work, finding people stable housing, and those are going to be the real challenges going forward, I think.
You know, Robert, you wrote about this whole process as well in your column this week about people who had been on the sort of receiving end of Operation Rio Grande. You spent some time with three different people who were either, on the street, in the shelter, or in recovery or in transitional housing. And these were, some of the intended, I guess, beneficiaries of this effort. What was their experience? Is it working for them?
Well, so the reason I went out and talked to those folks is because I felt like it was important to put a human face on the data, right? You know, we talked a lot about the numbers and the officials talk, point to the statistics a lot. But there is a human element to this. And so, one of the gentlemen I talked to, a man named Fabian Yazzie, had been homeless for about 2 years. He'd been living in the shelter. He had been trying to do, sort of day laborer kind of things, but couldn't make ends meet. So he and his wife were there. He got into the Dignity of Work program and got training out at Salt Lake Community College on how to frame homes. And ended up, he's been working there for, I believe it's 3 or 4 months now. They've moved into a temporary place, and he and his wife are, for the first time in several years, he's off drugs and alcohol, and they're kind of looking ahead to the future. There was a young woman named Emily Blaine that I talked to who, she had bounced between jail and shelters and, sort of volatile abusive relationships for a number of years. She was addicted to methamphetamine, and the state ended up taking her children from her. Her parents later adopted them. But she was living on the streets. She had warrants for her arrest, so she wasn't able to go to the shelter. Right. She ended up turning herself in a couple months after Operation Rio Grande started. She didn't plead into the drug court program, but she did get into a treatment program at Odyssey House alongside a lot of the people who did. And now she's in transitional housing. She's going to be moving into her own place next month. And she's, working again and, has her life back on track. And then the last one I talked to is a guy named Chris Coons, who was really an interesting character. I mean, this guy had been an electrician for years, made a good living, and then just sort of his life fell apart, And so he ended up on the street. He's been on the street for several years. And doesn't really have a lot of interest in getting into these programs. He knows they're there. He knows he's said, why would I want to really be in a house or an apartment? Why would I want them to give me an apartment that I can't afford to pay for? Mm-hmm. And he says he's not the type to hang around the apartment anyway. He'd rather, he was kind of critical, and he had a really interesting criticism of Operation Rio Grande in that it was so heavy on the law enforcement side of things.
Right.
He'd said that that he thinks it needs to be more of a mental health or treatment.
Yeah, I've got a quote from him that you quoted in his story. He said, "If being mentally ill didn't make you homeless, being homeless made you mentally ill. So why do you have cops and make it a legal issue?" And he was basically advocating for more mental health professionals to go along with police.
Yeah, I mean, his contention was that there should be a counselor or a mental health professional riding along in each car, in each police car. And obviously that becomes a logistical challenge. But he said that, he spends a lot of time with these people on the streets. He had seen a friend of his the day before that get hauled into jail because he had apparently had some sort of breakdown, maybe forgotten to take his meds. They called an ambulance. The cops got there first, and he ended up going to jail. And so this is sort of, in that instance in particular, this guy probably needed medical help or at least psychiatric help, and not necessarily to go to get locked up. So there's I guess no perfect answers to this, you know, and so it's they're navigating their way through it. But, you know, in the year ahead, I think it's really going to be the telling make or break for Operation Rio Grande, because what we've done, we've seen the progress so far that Peyton talked about. And they talked a little bit about what they're looking for in the year ahead, because you got to make these gains stick, or else you're going to backslide into a situation like we saw there a year ago.
You know, a question that I have is, you've got these 5,100 arrests, and then I'm guessing that would mark an increase in the number of arrests that were happening, because you had the stepped up presence of police as part of Operation Rio Grande. It makes me scratch my head a little bit. Aren't people arrested for crimes? How do you have a crime rate go down when arrests are being stepped up? Statistical question, I guess.
Yeah, so, and I guess, I mean, the only way that you can really understand that is if people that were once in this area just aren't there anymore. So it's like you have seen the dispersal of people from downtown, too. Yeah. And so it's like I spoke to some people, you know, who moved all the way down to, what is it, Midville. But, you know, I hear from some advocates that work with the homeless that say that they've heard that people have gone as far down to, like, Washington County and stuff, which I, you know, I didn't call them or anything, but that's what I'm hearing, you know.
Yeah, Peyton, you spoke with one woman who works with the homeless and who said that essentially, you know, this is dispersing them, and that makes their job as a homeless service provider more difficult because you have to go out and find the people who are experiencing this problem. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, because they used to all just sort of be in this one place, which was kind of the Pioneer Park area in Rio Grande. And so now, I mean, so they used to just be able to just come and kind of set up shop in the park, you know, and people could come and they primarily do syringe exchanges. And so people could come, you know, and exchange their syringes and go about their day. But once this happened, they found that, you know, they were seeing like over 1,000 people in the Rio Grande area. And then it dropped significantly after that. And so she's wondering, you know, where did these people go? Certainly they're still using drugs. You know, this is a problem that they're having to, you know, continue using these old syringes.
So she pointed to the hepatitis A outbreak in Utah people might be reusing needles, that kind of thing.
She did point to that, but I don't think hepatitis A can be contracted through syringes.
I don't know. We need a fact check on that.
I look, yeah. Yeah.
This makes their job harder. Robert Gerke, do you want to comment on that point on the sort of, was dispersal part of the intended plan for Operation Rio Grande?
Well, I think it was part of it. I mean, it was going to happen. I think the goal was to get the crime out of the area. You had sort of this chicken and egg effect, I think, where you had the homeless people who were downtown, that's where the service is located. And so that just sort of became the central, sort of the focal point of the homeless population statewide, really. I mean, if you look at it, there's a shelter up in Weber County. There's a shelter down in Washington County. But aside from that, most of the homeless services are located in that sort of 2 or 3 block radius, right, around the road home. And so, yeah, so you had this population there that part of the goal with the three new resource centers and spreading them out is to spread out the providing of services. But yeah, it does make it harder when you're dealing with a population that gets spread around, and you have people who, you know, are staying over on, who've moved over sort of to North Temple area, who've moved to the Jordan River Parkway area, who've moved, you know, one of the women I talked to just last week, as I was actually leaving the show last week, right, I was talking to her, I ran into her outside the library here, and I was talking to her about how things have changed, and she said it's gotten quieter, but it's gotten scarier, because she said, you know, you used to be able to avoid the downtown area if you wanted to avoid the crime and the drugs, but now it's kind of spread out everywhere. You don't know where it's going to be. So the dispersal is going to continue to be an issue, I think. And when these new shelters get online, which I believe is late next year, you'll start seeing sort of a settling, I guess, of you know, things may kind of coalesce a little bit
in certain areas. What does come next, Peyton? This is a multi-phase project. We've gone through some of these phases already, and now we're, I guess, what's on the horizon for Operation Rio Grande? Robert's pointing to these shelters being open.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's pretty much it. They've sort of done this law enforcement part, and they've, you know, said multiple times you can't arrest your way out of this problem. So this is kind of where they they stop doing that. You know, they get the shelters online, they get more people into treatment, and that's phase two. I mean, that's what they're looking into in this next year.
When we talked a little bit, I think the most important piece is the affordable housing piece.
I mean,
we've got an affordable housing crisis in the state. It's going to take some investment from the state to deal with that. And so that's going to take some changes to the zoning process. These cities have this sort of not in my backyard syndrome where they don't want density, they don't want low income housing, they don't want shelters, but they're fine if Salt Lake takes it, but they also don't want homeless people in their neighborhood. So it's, you can't have it all. And so if we're going to have a long-term solution, we've got to deal with the affordable housing crisis. There's some interesting sort of novel ideas, and one of them that I've heard they're looking at is this strategy that LA has employed, where they take shipping containers and turn them into sort of mobile. I mean, they can be mobile. They're stationary, but they can be moved around. Apartments, basically, for the homeless population. And
would those get dropped off in a neighborhood and then become?
Well, again, you've got to find a place to locate them, right? And so nobody's going to be too keen on the idea of having them in their neighborhood. But this is something we're going to have to overcome. And if the cities aren't willing to play ball and be partners in it, then the state's going to have to step in and make them be partners.
Was there an affordable housing component of Operation Rio Grande, or was that just sort of separate? I mean, the Tribune reported this week that Utah still needs tens of thousands of housing units for low-income residents.
42,500 is where we're short right now.
Yeah, and we're experiencing population boom. That number could increase. I guess, there's funding for treatment, there's funding for these justice courts, and there is funding for the stepped-up police presence. Has there been funding considered for affordable housing from the state level or from the city?
There was a really interesting bill last session that Steve Elison, Representative Steve Elison, sponsored, and basically it would say if these cities aren't doing their part, if they don't have adequate affordable housing, they'll pay a tax basically to the state, and the state will use that to dole out matching grants to cities that are willing to do affordable housing. And the idea is then everybody shares the burden somewhat. So, if Draper doesn't want affordable housing in their neighborhood, then they're going to get taxed, and that tax will go to pay for affordable housing in, Salt Lake or West Valley or someplace else like that. That bill didn't pass because the cities obviously weren't crazy about the idea of being taxed, and they also aren't crazy about the idea of being forced to take affordable housing. So I think it will be back this year. But again, it seems obvious, I guess, but the solution to homelessness is homes. Mm-hmm. And so that's where there's really going to have to be a focus, I think, in the coming year.
Finally, just, you mentioned the new shelters coming online. The old shelter, the Road Home Shelter, is still meant to be closed. Do we know what's going to happen to that property where the Road Home Shelter is? And the state wants to buy it, I think.
Yeah, the state's looking to buy it right now. The problem they're running into is that the property value has basically doubled, I believe, or maybe tripled.
What would they do with it, by the way, if they did buy it?
They're talking about putting archives there, historic archives. That's one of the things
archives is down sort of on the south side of the Rio Grande Station right now, and it probably needs to expand to some degree. I don't know if they've got a firm plan on what to do with it, but yeah, it is one of the things that they're trying to tackle in the coming months, really. I mean, they've got to start coming up with a plan on shutting down the Road Home and what to do with the property afterwards.
There's a hard close date of June of June of 2020 or
2020.
Yeah. Okay. Or next year, 2019. Yeah, you're right.
The homeless coordinating committee, I guess, is studying the what to do with it, how to shut it down, sort of how to phase it out, and also what to do with the land after it's closed.
All right. Well, there's still a few balls in the air, and we'll see what happens in the coming few months. We got to head to a break. When we come back, is it the Mormon Church, the LDS Church? Actually, it's neither. We'll try to clear up the confusion after a break. I'm Roger McDonough. You're listening to Behind the Headlines. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Managing Editor David Noyce, reporter Peyton Harkins, and columnist Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255, or post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. David Noyce, Managing Editor, there is a big religious group here in town, the major Utah-based faith. What is the name of that church again, David?
The one formerly known as the Mormons, is that the one?
Yeah.
First of all, let me just say, in describing what's happened, I'm going to violate left and right the LDS churches, as I just said, edict. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the predominant faith, is once again, they've tried this before, trying to get media, members, not people who aren't members of the faith, everyone to stop referring to them as the Mormon Church or the LDS Church. They want the full name of the church used, at least when you're first referring to them. And to stop calling members Mormons or LDS. Latter-day Saints would be acceptable, according to them.
Why is this being done?
Well, the main reason it's being done, I guess, is that the new president of the LDS Church, who was installed in January, said it should be done. His statement was rather remarkable yesterday in the fact that he referred to himself, saying, "The Lord has impressed upon me that we need to take seriously how we use the name of our church."
And the head of the faith is considered a prophet.
Russell Nelson, yes, considered a prophet. It's remarkable in the fact that most of these statements, although they may be based on some or what the LDS Church or officials would refer to as revelatory experiences, rarely use that language in a public statement. So that was rather remarkable. I think the other reason are several, of course. Number one is the church still feels like many people don't identify them as Christian, members of the faith as Christian. Mormon certainly doesn't say Christian in it. However, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints does have a Christian root there. So that's another reason, and also possibly to distance itself from some of the offshoot groups, polygamous groups, things like that.
One thing I just wonder if this advice will stick. I mean, the Catholic Church might want us to call them the Apostolic Church of Rome or whatever, but are people going to do that is the question. And the church has tried this before, correct?
Yes, they did. They tried maybe about 15 years ago. There was a real effort. It's been tried even before that to try to do that. And it was a pretty concerted effort, in advance of the 2002 Winter Olympics. It didn't work. And eventually, the church didn't just abandon that. They doubled down. They embraced the term Mormon. They launched the Meet the Mormons
campaign.
Movie. 2014, the I'm a Mormon campaign, which was a very successful media campaign. They have their Mormon newsroom,
the website
Mormon and Gay, Mormon.org or LDS.org. So they sort of embraced the term wholeheartedly.
And what happens to the world famous Mormon Tabernacle Choir?
Good question. We asked that specific question, as a matter of fact, expecting to get an answer, because there are some exceptions that the church listed in its style edict. For instance, the Mormon Trail is a historic reference. It's nationally recognized historically. In their mind, Mormon Trail is fine.
Grandfathered in, sort of.
Exactly. In their mind, yes. And so we asked Mormon Tabernacle Choir, world famous, been around since, longest running radio broadcast since 1929, known the world over, has a very, very positive brand. We asked that specific question, is that going to be renamed? They said, we'll have to just see, essentially. The spokesman says, we don't know, stay tuned.
No answer, okay.
No answers yet, which I find interesting that they didn't dismiss it outright, number one. but maybe that would fit under the historical exception as they see it.
Mm. I guess when you look at how newsrooms are going to respond to this will be interesting. If the AP style guide makes the change, then okay, right. But otherwise, our newspaper is going to, I know that this is advice for everybody, including people who are not working in media, but what's the Tribune going to do about this? Are you guys going to continue? Are you going to follow this advice?
Well, we've launched several projects in the past year. We have a Mormon Land podcast.
Right.
We have a Mormon Land newsletter. Obviously, people look to us, being in the headquarters of the church and have an award-winning religion writer here that covers it, for some independent reporting on that. So they look to us for that kind of coverage, so we sort of embrace the term as well. Our editor, we asked our editor, and it's, we have a story in our story today on online that we see no reason right now to abandon our style. Mm-hmm. We talked with a lot of people. We talked with Jana Reese of Religion News Service. She said it was a senior columnist there. She's also Mormon. Said it's highly unlikely media widely will use that term because they're looking for a single term, a single word for clarity and precision that can be used.
It's cumbersome to say the Church of Jesus Christ.
You're not going to say that every time, and plus it's not precise, and it's going to be unclear sometimes who you're referring to. We'll see if it catches on. I mean, we were batting this about around, in recent weeks even. If you did a one-word term, what would it be? And it's hard to come up with one,
right?
That would actually work.
Didn't the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints recently do a rebranding like 5 or 6 years ago?
Well, they're called the Community of Christ now. And
yeah.
Once again, now that's lost in some respects. You know what I mean? If you say Community of Christ, I'm not sure people would know who you're referring to.
Right. Okay.
And it's the same way we do when we cover. I say the University of Utah, our editor noted, we'll say University of Utah, but we may say U on second reference or Utes or Utah, depending if there's context there.
Right.
So
the question is, will you, though, continue to say the Mormon Church? And that'll be, I guess we'll see in as it comes out on second reference.
And the Deseret News, of course, has a decision to make, too, although it sounds like they're going to make some changes because they have the Mormon Times that they publish, once a week.
They're owned by the church itself.
Well, yeah, and I'm kind of curious, too, like Mormon missionaries, are they now Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints missionaries? It's like
it's cumbersome.
There's a lot of questions.
Yeah.
So
how about within the faith? How are people within the faith responding to this announcement? Have there been?
Well, it's kind of early. Most of the people we talked to yesterday were Mormons, but more commentators and observers also. I think one of the dangers is that was noted, and I think is a real danger, is if some members of the church don't adopt this language, will they be judged in their congregations as not following their church leaders' counsel? It's gonna take some adjustment on that part also.
Sounds like an expensive endeavor too. I mean, if you're gonna launch new websites and rebrand everything you have, big companies don't do this because of the fact that they're so well known by the name Pepsi or whatever.
Right. A lot of people question the time, energy, and money that will be expended on something that maybe is not that big of a problem, if it's a problem at all.
I assume the Book of Mormon will continue to be
that is accepted in there because that's a proper name, and so that would still be okay.
Maybe we can start calling them Formans.
Formans. Yeah. Once again, a little lack of precision, huh?
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, as long as we're talking about religion in Utah, I want to turn to a different story that was in the Tribune this week, the theology of marijuana. I say that kind of tongue-in-cheek. There's a medical marijuana initiative that will appear on our November ballot. It would expand the availability of the drug beyond the limited group that that gets it now, those who are terminally ill who can be prescribed this drug. Opponents of that initiative in a court filing this week, David, used a novel argument that had to do with religion. Can you tell us what they said?
Yeah, this is the Coalition for a Safe and Healthy Utah. Okay, that filed this lawsuit. The provision for Prop 2, the marijuana initiative, says that a landlord, for instance, would not be able to refuse to rent an apartment to someone who uses medical marijuana. That's the basis they're sort of using for this legal argument, such as it is, that you would then be forcing a landlord to rent to somebody who's going against something their religion, in their mind, would be against.
So essentially, they're saying the law shouldn't tell me I can't rent to someone who has permission to use
medical marijuana. They point to the Colorado Baker as which is also probably not the best one to use,
right,
for that example. The interesting thing about the argument is that the LDS Church hasn't really said it's against medical marijuana.
Right.
As a matter of fact, in the states where it's legal, members there can get temple recommends. They're still full-fledged members in good standing. So it's
because they're essentially using a legal
drug.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. I was going to say, how would renting to, or how would you know, somebody using medical marijuana violate a member of the church's religious beliefs in the minds of those who are filing this court filing?
Yeah, well, I mean, they wouldn't be. It's just the landlord would have to, they would say, well, you know, they're going against something that my religion is against,
yeah,
I guess.
I mean, the way it's phrased in the lawsuit is that, you know, they find it repugnant to use mind-altering drugs, even though that's not technically in the Word of Wisdom that they're referring, you know, when they refer back to it. And there are things that are prohibited in the Word of Wisdom that we obviously don't outlaw, you know, alcohol, tobacco, you know, caffeinated drinks, strong hot drinks, you know, all of those things. We're not trying to ban all of those things, but this lawsuit would seek to ban medical or would seek to keep the initiative from being on the ballot because they said it would infringe on their religious liberties, which is kind of, I mean, and we kind of had this discussion already, I think, when we were talking about the LGBT anti-discrimination law statewide now and the ordinance before that. Landlords can't discriminate against people who are gay or lesbian when it comes to housing and rentals because, you know, it's just because they feel like it's, you know, a violation of their, you know, because they disagree with the lifestyle, you know. Right. And so it's a kind of an absurd argument.
You could do all sorts of parallels. There are people who use religious justifications not to vaccinate their kids, for example. And so by the same logic, you know, if those people owned an apartment building, couldn't they say, you know, if this were the law, couldn't they say, hey, if you've vaccinated, you can't rent here? That seems like
you can't discriminate. You can't say somebody who, you know, uses insulin for their diabetes can't be, you know, can't rent your apartment. So now you're starting to pick and choose which medicine is okay. If somebody uses fentanyl for, you know, cancer, or uses medical marijuana for their cancer-related pain, what's the difference in that situation, right? You also have a situation where if somebody's using it, say, for multiple sclerosis, you have prohibitions at the federal level against discriminating against somebody with disability, and you're going to run into that situation if you try to take this to a logical conclusion.
So like a fair housing violation.
A fair housing violation. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know that they've really thought through, but it's also more at the core, I think, you know, they're using the free exercise clause of the Constitution to make a claim that they can impose their religious beliefs on everybody through the law. And that's just not the way it's supposed to work. And not only that, there's an establishment clause of the Constitution as well, and in the state constitution says there shall be no union of church and state, and what they're trying to do is impose those religious views through the law on everybody else, and it's just I don't think they've really thought this through very well.
David Noyce, what do proponents of the initiative say about this new argument coming out in these legal filings?
That they're desperate. Essentially, you mean the proponents of the initiative?
That
this is a desperate move. I think DJ Shantz, the leader of it, compared it to Jim McMahon's Holiday Bowl miracle toss to Clay Brown,
which was completed, by the way.
Exactly.
So maybe not the best parallel.
That's what I was going to say. I was probably going to use a Hail Mary. I'd use one that didn't work, frankly, but that one did work. So
they're not as famous though.
But no question.
Has the church said anything? I mean, you kind of pointed this already, David. But has the church about this particular part of the proposed law where you would forbid landlords from, you know, where you wouldn't allow them to discriminate based on holding that card?
Well, it's been interesting to watch the church's actions on the medical marijuana initiative in this. In the legal document that they released from the law firm, essentially explaining all the dangers and perils of approving medical marijuana, did refer to this issue of the housing thing. They were kind of throwing a kitchen sink at everything, though, in that document about what they think could be a problem. Interesting thing is watching the church navigate this. I don't think there's any question that the church is trying to defeat this without coming right out and saying don't vote for it. So it's been interesting to watch, and we'll probably have to continue to watch that till election day.
Robert, is some of this about the effectiveness also of the drug itself? I mean, do we know? I mean, about the debate of how much help medical marijuana provides for people who have cancer, HIV.
That's a common thread of argument among legislators in particular, is that the science on the efficacy of the drug as it relates to certain diseases is not all that fleshed out. There was a big study from the National Institutes of Health. It was not a study, I guess, but a survey of all of the data, all of the studies that are out there, a compilation of all the data that's out there. And, you know, it said, yeah, in some cases there's really compelling scientific proof, scientific evidence that it works, and in some cases it's tenuous. So so that's one of the common arguments that you hear over and over with this. One more thing on the on the church, I think it's kind of interesting that in our recent Tribune poll, the last time we polled this issue, 2/3 of Mormons, self-identified Mormons, support medical marijuana. And so for this lawsuit to claim to speak on behalf of the Mormons, like the Lorax speaks for the trees, is sort of a little bit of a stretch. And I think it also poses a problem for the church, because they did, I mean, their statement on when they released that big memo, it was pretty clear, I think. Mm-hmm. And it didn't really move the needle all that much. And so I'm not sure that if they do come out and say, don't vote for this, I mean, I think conference in October is going to be interesting.
Right before the initiative, see how they navigate.
I mean, you
do have a heart surgeon at the head of the LDS Church right now. Now, I doubt he very much that he's read the latest, you know, New England Journal of Medicine research. But
it just needs a simple majority to pass. Will it get that? I wonder. I mean, polling says that it's maybe, maybe not.
With these, well, I mean, again, our last poll I think had almost 3/4 of the public in support of it, including 2/3 of Mormons. And so the church's opposition didn't really put a dent in it. But the wild card here, as Dave mentioned, is how strongly does the church come out against it? How well-funded is the opposition group, and are they able to be effective? And you also, when you go into these initiatives, we've seen it over and over that on election day, they're polling, you know, 5 or 10 points ahead, and then end up not getting there because there's always a big drop-off once voters get to the voting booth. So I think it looks right now, it looks pretty good, but things can change pretty dramatically in the next 2 months.
If Russell Nelson comes out with a statement akin to what he had yesterday on the name of the church and said, you know, the word of the Lord has rested on my mind that you shouldn't vote for medical marijuana, I think that would definitely change the needle a lot.
Right. But. Well, we will know for certain in just a couple of months whether or not it passes. We need to head to yet another break on the show, and when we return, a Utah driver's license design flaw that might throw a wrench in your travel plans. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's David Noyce, Peyton Harkins, and Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us by calling 801-355-8255 with your questions and comments. I kind of want to start this segment off with an experiment, which is I'm going to pull out my driver's license to examine it, and Peyton, Dave, and Robert, you can feel free to do the same. Listeners, you can join in the fun at home. We're going to be looking for a little gold star on the top right corner of the card itself. Actually, I have to grab my driver's license here. My driver's license does not have anything there, just some intricate lines and a sort of mountain motif in the background. Do you guys have any stars on your driver's licenses?
Utah driver license, no.
No star.
Peyton?
Yeah, I'm Oklahoma, and no star.
Okay, it's sort of a weird experiment. I'm sorry. Dave Noyce.
Play along at home.
Yeah,
that's right.
The fact that we can't see a star there is apparently a problem, at least according to the Department of Homeland Security. And why is that the case?
Well, the bigger problem is the picture, but that's let's talk about that problem.
Yeah,
the Department of Homeland Security wants a gold star there as basically as a quick thing, like when you're going through screening at the airport, that they can quickly see that you have passed all the citizenship bona fides, you know, prove that you're a U.S. citizen before you can go through security. This needs to be in place apparently by sometime in October of 2020. And if it's not, then you basically may not be able to get on a plane.
Why is it why is it not there now, or and should it be there right now? I mean, this is...
Well, in the Fed's mind, it probably should be. Utah did all this to get compliance in 2012, like 6 years ago. If you remember going to the driver license division, you had to bring like a passport or a birth... Remember, you had to get the birth certificate. It really clogged up the lines for a long time. It made it hard sometimes to get your... People would come, wouldn't have all the documents they need. They have to go back. If you remember all that, you know, we all the motors here got a license, did that. So in federal mind, got the compliance from the Department of Homeland Security saying, okay, you've complied, you're good. At the time, there wasn't that this gold star wasn't, or this mark wasn't required, although there apparently was talk of it at the time. So in a sense, Utah's complied but doesn't have the proof on the license that it's complied.
As of right now, is this a problem? I mean, if I'm traveling to a public radio conference this weekend and I don't have the gold star, is it possible that I'm not going to be able to fly?
It shouldn't be a problem now. When I went to Europe last month, it wasn't a problem. So I don't think it's a problem yet, but it will be a problem in 2020, or could be at least.
Starting in 2020, they'll take your kids away and lock them in cages if you
don't
have the gold star.
That's right.
Well, no, I went there.
Masquerading as affordable housing. Yes.
Well, it is interesting because it is. I mean, you described this, Dave, as a way of weeding out people who are citizens versus non-citizens. You know, non-citizens have driver's licenses as well. This is the intent of the program, I guess, is to try and figure out quickly who has those bona fides and who doesn't.
Yeah, there's also like identification cards that the state has too.
Utah started issuing its ID cards probably. Gosh, they've been doing that for a long time, probably around the same time, 2012. But I presume that those would not have the gold star on it once Utah goes to
that
the gold
store. That could cause problems with traveling, yes.
Yeah. They say it's going to cost a fair amount of money to fix this, Dave?
$5 million, wow. They think, to issue everyone a new card, which, you know, is not billion, but that's not chump change either.
They can't just send you a gold star to stick on.
Right. If we all just do really well on our spelling tests.
I remember getting those. Okay, so and it's $5 million. If Utah changed right now, if they hurried and started doing it, and started issuing these cards now, they would save maybe $1.5 million, you know, off that because people are renewing all the time. So that would help trim the cost a little bit. Although legislators here seem to want to push the feds to change this, so that's what they want the delegation to work on. They want essentially them to lobby and try to get the administration to change that, you know, their stance.
It seems like a bureaucratic. I mean, so bureaucratic what this is. It's really interesting.
It reeks of it, yes.
Okay, well, moving on. Dave, just before we turn to our final segment of the show, we earlier were talking about the medical marijuana initiative that's going to be on the ballot this November, an initiative that did not make the cut this November is the Count My Vote initiative, which would further solidify the law that made it possible to gather signatures to get on the ballot in Utah. It isn't expected to be on the ballot, but organizers want the Utah Supreme Court to do something about that. Can you just quickly fill us in here, Dave?
Well, they would like the court to put it on the ballot, of course. They made arguments to the justices, and basically the argument is, if you remember why it Count My Vote, that initiative did not, which would have solidified, I believe, and codified the dual path to the ballot, you know, whether through the convention, the traditional caucus convention system, or through gathering of petition signatures. This would have essentially cemented it into law, I guess.
Isn't it already law?
Is already law. They wanted to sort of reaffirm it, I guess, and there was also some changes that they wanted to make about how, you know, replacement candidates are selected and for legislative. It also changes the ballot, the signature thresholds that would be required. So it does some tweaking. It is not a sort of monumental shift. It's sort of more fine tuning.
It's because the Republican Party is still fighting this, of course. Yeah. This, and so I think there's still some fear that they'll go back to the caucus convention system strictly. It got removed from the ballot because opponents were successful in getting just some signatures removed from the ballot petition in a few Senate districts, a relative small amount actually compared to the overwhelming more than 180,000 or whatever signatures they gathered. Yeah. That succeeded. Then Lieutenant Governor said that succeeded in defeating it from getting on the ballot. So essentially, they made the argument to justice that the cards are stacked against us. This is not right, and kind of, it's not equitable. And should be changed.
There is a constitutional a section of the Constitution that gives the citizens the right to organize a ballot initiative, and their argument is that the legislature has made it so difficult and so onerous to get on the ballot that it's infringing, from a practical standpoint, on that right. One of the problems they've got to overcome is that three of the four ballot initiatives that were proposed this year did make it on. I think the counter argument to that is two of them really didn't have any opposition, and the one that did you know, barely made it on. The medical marijuana initiative barely made it on. So they said with giving the opponents 30 days to go out and get people to remove their signatures in selected Senate districts where, you know, it's harder to get on, the rural Senate districts primarily, it effectively denies the citizens the right to a ballot initiative. The justices seemed pretty skeptical of that when they were during the hearing.
Are they still considering it? I mean, they are weighing this right now?
Well, they probably have to decide before August 31st if it's going to get on, because that's the deadline for essentially, you know, firming up the ballot.
Yeah, they've got to send the ballots to be printed.
So expecting a decision
soon. And
they've got
to get it mailed out overseas to military, just under federal guidelines. So they're going to be issuing an opinion fairly soon, but they didn't issue an opinion then. Justice Lee, Justice Durant seemed pretty opposed to it. Justice Simonis is kind of one of these guys who likes to test both sides, you know, and so he was pretty. And then Justice Pierce, because he was Gary Herbert's legal counsel when this whole thing was going on, it recused himself. The new justice, and I'm blanking on her name now. I'm sorry, Paige Peterson. Thank
yes,
you.
Paige, yeah.
She seemed pretty open and amenable to the count my vote argument. So I guess it kind of comes down to Justice Orme, who is sitting in for Pierce, and then Justice Simonis, which way he goes. But I'm not confident that this is going to work, because the remedy that they're seeking is pretty drastic, you know, to say that the people who took their signatures off shouldn't have been able to take their signatures off kind of deprives them of what they were recognizing as a constitutional right to remove their signatures. So and the legislature's right to set the parameters for under which the ballot initiatives are able to go forward. So it seems like we talked about Hail Marys earlier, you know. Maybe this is going to be a Doug Flutie Hail Mary.
It's a heavy lift.
Didn't that one work too?
That one worked too.
Yeah, sorry.
I mean, this initiative did, you know, you talk about the others that made the ballot. This initiative, however, does kind of cut to the heart of who holds power in Utah. Mm-hmm. So I think it might be the one that legislators are most interested in, and office holders and the powers that be.
A fun little side note, the main Supreme Court precedent on this issue was argued, I'm going to blank on the year, but I think it was like 2002. And the two attorneys who argued that for Jack Gallivan were John Pierce and Dino Jimonas, who are now both on the court.
Oh, that is interesting. Great bit of history there. Thank you, Robert. I mean, and at the same time, count my vote remains law one way or another. So it's sort of, it's just a difference of how many signatures you might gather and kind of a refining of that law.
Exactly. And I think regardless of whether they get on the ballot or not, you're going to see them sort of reassess the signature thresholds, because there were some questions raised about that during the course of the federal litigation.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for this recap, you guys. The time has now come for us to turn to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week. And Peyton Harkins, since you have been waiting here patiently, maybe we'll start with you and have you go with your pick for underplayed story.
Okay, so mine is from the Tribune's own Courtney Tanner. She wrote a story about a trans student at BYU who is currently in this conflict with their bishop about whether or not they're going to sign off on them going to BYU again next year. And it's all kind of dependent on whether or not they get this top surgery to remove their breast. And that's an interesting conflict in itself. But I think that Courtney does a really good job of kind of showing us the intimate details of this like unique family dynamic going on, because this person has a husband and a child.
Wow.
I don't know. Very, very cool.
Check out Courtney Tanner's story at sltrib.com. David Noyce, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
Today, the remains of Robert Kimball Holmes, Marine private first class, will be returned to the state 77 years after he died on the USS Oklahoma in Pearl Harbor. He was last seen on the deck of Oklahoma firing his pistol at Japanese planes overhead.
Wow. A really interesting story there as well, from David Noyce. Robert Gerke, your pick for Underplayed Story.
Mine seems trivial now, but if you have time, go read Robert Kirby's column today, where he outs himself as a Mormon and a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and a user of medical marijuana. He says he suffers from, you know, leg injuries, knee injuries, and he uses it for pain. And he doesn't really care if the ballot initiative passes or not. He's going to continue using it. And it has the typical Kirby flair that we've all come to love.
How dare you call Robert Kirby trivial? Okay.
Apologies, Robert. I'm going to go with the story of another fallen hero, Utah firefighter Matt Burchett, who died Monday fighting the largest blaze in California history. There was a remarkable procession to welcome his remains back to Utah that Peyton Harkins, who's here in studio with us, wrote in the Tribune. People lining the streets to pay their respects. Though it's been years, I knew Matt and his family growing up, and it's difficult to imagine their anguish. And I just have to say that there are all of these phrases that we use about people when they die. He never had anything negative to say about anyone. He had a big heart. He was the epitome of a good guy, and so on and so on. And I'm sure that they're true in every instance, but they were that much more true for the Mapperchet that I knew and remember, and our deep sympathy to his family. Hold your people close, everybody. David Noyce, Peyton Harkins, Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This show is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much to our operations and programming guru, Jesse Ellis, here at KCPW, to the team at Utah Public Radio in Logan, and to the show's producer, Emily Means. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We are at KCPWFM on Twitter and KCPWFM on Facebook. I am drawing out the show because we've got a little bit more time to cover you guys, and so thanks for hanging out with me. Next week on the show, who knows what we'll be covering? Any predictions?
I think we'll be talking more about medical marijuana, and we'll probably be talking, but I'm sure the LDS Church will...
Church name might pop up.
Yes. All right. How about Peyton Harkins? Any predictions on the news for next week?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I cover breaking news.
The fate of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir is still hanging out there. Yeah. So.
Okay. Fantastic. Well, again, you guys, thanks very much for being here, and thanks for listening to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. We will see you next week.